Earlier today, the results from the 2014 National Assessment of Educational Progress, better known as the Nation's Report Card, were released. This time around, the test measured eighth graders' proficiency in the subjects of geography, history, and civics. The results? Well, not so good.
Only about a quarter of the kids tested scored at a level considered proficient or above in the three subjects. That's relatively unchanged from the last time students were tested on these subjects 4 years ago.
It's got a lot of people asking why, and it's got some calling for a shakeup of history and civics classes in the United States.
Joining us now to discuss all of this is Scott Warren. He's the co-founder and executive director of Generation Citizen, a group trying to take a different approach to civics education. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
So these numbers, a little underwhelming, consistent with what came up 4 years ago or so. So what's the deal? How do you explain this?
Well, I think one of the things is this isn't surprising at all, as you said. We knew that these results were going to come out. We knew that they probably weren't going to have improved. And I think it really speaks to two things. One is that we're not prioritizing civics. So I think you hear about the subjects that American students aren't doing well in, but that we are prioritizing subjects like STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, English, subjects that we should be prioritizing, but because of that, civics gets a backseat, as do geography and history. But the second part of it is that when we do teach it, we don't necessarily teach it well. So even the word civics, when we talk about it at Generation Citizen, it's, you know, people fall asleep just hearing the word. They think of, here are the three branches of government, here's how a bill becomes a law. And we need to, you know, I really think that civics can become the most exciting class in school, so we need to teach it differently. But without doing that, without actually making it a priority, without changing the way that we teach it, these results are going to flatline and they're going to stagnate. And I think we'll see the exact same thing happen in 4 years when these results come out again.
Well, zooming in on the civics aspect of this test for a moment, what were some of the particular items from the test that especially worried you?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, you touched on it before, that only a quarter of students are proficient. And when you're thinking about the types of questions that they're asking, there was, you know, there are questions related to how our government actually works. There are questions relating to the fact that we have a democracy, and, you know, that students couldn't even recognize the fact that we live in a democracy, and that's something important to who we are as a country. I think the other thing I should say is that these tests mostly focus on knowledge, and it's incredibly important for young people to understand civics knowledge, but that's an incomplete picture. They're also not getting the skills that they need to participate, and they're also not motivated to actually participate. So we think about knowledge, skills, and motivation. These tests just measure the knowledge, but the picture of the skills and the motivation, which you can actually measure through behavior, and the fact that young people aren't showing up at the polls, is something that, you know, that we've seen as well.
So someone who doesn't get civics can still, you know, get a job, live a happy, satisfied life. What do we lose by not having a deeper understanding of civics, of how the way our government, our society work?
I think that's the question that we as a field need to do a better job arguing. I think that, you know, in the current climate we're in, with high unemployment, with wages stagnating, people see civics as a nice to have and not as a need to have. And so these are conversations that we have with schools all the time. And I think if you look at our democracy, you know, it's not working the way that it used to. You had 2/3 of people that stayed home during the midterm elections. You have a approval rating of Congress in the single digits. We like to blame Washington all the time for our political problems, but I think we need to sometimes look inward and say, well, you know, why aren't we participating? The answer for a broken political process is not to disengage with politics. I think it's to get more engaged. And so where does that start? That starts with actually educating our young people to be politically active. We use an analogy a lot. When young people turn 16 in this country, they can get a driver's license. But they don't just wake up at 16 and have a license. You know, they have to get a permit, they have to take lessons, they have to eventually take a test. But that's almost how we treat our democracy. It's like students wake up at the age of 18 and we all of a sudden expect them to know how to vote. So if you look at the test today, it's almost like you have 75% of students failing the driver's test, but then giving them a license when they actually turn 16. And so I think that's the problem, is that our democracy is only as good as the citizenry that's upholding it, and we're not making sure that they come to the plate when they can actually participate, ready and informed to take the reins.
Well, and you said part of the problem is that we're not teaching civics very well. What's wrong with the way that we teach civics, and how could we make it better?
I just don't think that it's as exciting as it can be. You know, the rote way of civics is, you know, here are the three branches of government, here's how a bill becomes a law. I think it sort of approximates how Americans see politics right now, which is this dirty, messy thing that we have to engage in but don't really want to engage in. And, you know, we talk about politics because we have to, but, you know, it's not something that's particularly fun. And I think if we can get civics to be something that students look forward to taking, something that's actually applicable to their own lives. We at Generation Citizen think about something called action civics, where students learn about the political process through taking action on issues that they care about. If you look at all the studies about the best way to learn science, it's through doing engaging experiments. The best way to learn engineering is by doing robotics. The best way to do math is by engaging in real-world math problems. And so we need to treat civics like that. And the best way to learn civics is actually by getting young people to take action on issues that they care about. And so I think if that becomes our approach to civics, a more action-oriented approach, you actually see better knowledge on these tests because students wouldn't see it as something that's really not applicable to their own lives. And I think that's the way we see civics now as something, you know, we have to learn these rote details of what happened in the 1800s with our Constitution, rather than saying this is really exciting, and we want to figure out how we can make change in our own lives. And that's what civics actually is.
We're talking right now with Scott Warren from the group Generation Citizen about improving the way we learn about civics here in the United States, and we want to hear from you, too.
What do you think of low test scores for civics and history? Why do you think they're low, and what do you see as the consequences? What needs to be done to shake these classes up, make them more relevant? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking right now with Scott Warren of Generation Citizen about history and civics education in America. The latest test results from the nation's report card show low proficiency in these subjects. We're trying to find out why and what can be done about it.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Why do you think today's eighth graders and other young people may not be scoring so well when it comes to knowledge of how our government works, how the system works? What are the consequences of that? Do you teach? Have you taught civics in the schools? What works? What doesn't for you to get people excited and to get them to learn? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Scott, I mean, this might be one of those kids these days sort of things, or do you think there's always been some element of this, a portion of us who don't know, maybe don't care that much about civics in our country?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good question. I think the results have gone down from their peak, and I think voting rates for young people, you know, have decreased a bit, although 18-year-olds only got the right to vote in the 1970s. But I think, you know, now is a specific time where the, you know, citizenry as a whole is pretty skeptical about politics, and I think this drains its way down to our young people. I also think that's what's happening in our education system is that there's been a little bit of an overcorrection towards accountability. So there probably wasn't enough accountability, and now, you know, I think with all these debates on testing happening, what's happening is that subjects like civics just aren't as part of the curriculum as they used to be, because the subjects that are tested on, mainly STEM and literacy, receive the bulk of attention. And so I think that, you know, it's not just the case of young people these days. I think, you know, you tend to see people get a little bit more politically active when they're older. But I think we can really start young and get them young, but the problem is that we're not making it a priority in our education system.
Well, yeah, you mentioned STEM being emphasized in the classroom right now, and classroom time is at a premium, and a lot of people saying if our country wants to advance itself on the global stage, we have to look at science, tech, engineering, math. How do we make room for STEM and, you know, history, civics, geography?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question. I think one of the things that has to be done in schools, generally speaking, is making things more interdisciplinary. There's been a little bit of a debate about STEM versus the humanities. Fareed Zakaria wrote a Washington Post opinion article about 2 weeks ago decrying the rise of STEM. And I don't think the problem is STEM. I think the problem is when we see it as STEM or this or that. And I think there's really ways, for example, when you're talking about civics, why not incorporate analyzing survey results of city planners into math class? Why not incorporate, you know, analyzing pollution water levels into science class? There's ways to combine things to make sure that the STEM classes are actually using, you know, current policy debates, and that civics classes are doing the same with STEM. So I think the problem we get into is when we separate all the subjects, and you're right that there is finite time in a day, and because of that, I think we have to figure out ways to bring everything together more.
Let's bring a caller on board now. We've got Jim on the line in Milwaukee. Jim, hi.
Hi, yeah, I teach high school at a local suburban school. And in speaking with my colleagues, especially at the elementary school level, they say the major problem is that now with all the extra things you have to do with testing and everything, the one subject that they always take time away from is social studies.
Jim, thanks a lot for sharing that perspective. Scott, we're cutting social studies at an early level, and that trickles, I guess, upward in this case.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly it. And I think, you know, there are some movements to try to get social studies to be tested more. And I think the other part of it is how do you potentially lessen the stakes of some of the tests that are happening? But I think this happens across the board. One of the interesting things about this test is that it only tested eighth graders. 4 years ago when they did this test, it tested fourth and 12th graders as well. The reason they only did eighth graders this year is because of federal budget cuts. So we care about civics and history and geography so little that we're not even ponying up money to test it. And so I think, you know, it's right, but it's happening across the board. It's happening at the federal level, the state level, the district level. I think part of it is testing. I think part of it is that we're just not emphasizing it enough. We're not having these conversations. We're not talking about why it's important.
Well, thanks for that, Colin. We're going to go next to Sherry Ann in Mazomanie. Hi, Sherry Ann.
Hi, yes. I would like to say that when I was in high school, I went to school in Greenbelt, Maryland, and we had a government teacher, they called it government, not civics at the time, named Mr. Grabenstein, and he made civics so much fun. He actually would play NPR in the classroom and for our daily subjects and stuff. And he had us actually vote to see where we would sit in our classroom, to see where, you know, and who would represent our class. He was very, 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 he was very, very active in our student civics, and we had a lot of elections from everything from treasurer to class, for our class to our actual graduating class. Civics.
Thanks so much for sharing your experience, Sherry Ann. And obviously a hands-on teacher getting kids involved and making it seem relevant why they're learning. It sounds like that's the kind of thing you think would be good.
Yeah, that's what we try to do. And I think what's interesting, too, is that we talk to a lot of people that say, you know, when I was, and this isn't to be ageist, you know, but when I was younger, we had civics, we had government, and what happened? And I think part of what we have to do is, and hopefully these tests help accomplish that, is just to get people to realize that we don't teach civics anymore. Because I think people sometimes think it's still happening because they had it when they were younger. So, you know, I think we need teachers exactly like that, and we also need to realize that we're not teaching it like we used to.
Scott, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
That was Scott Warren, co-founder and executive director of Generation Citizen. He joined us to talk about history and civics education in America and what can be done to shake things up in light of low test scores.
You can keep sharing your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page.
A new initiative is underway in Milwaukee, one that's looking to breathe new life into some of the city's poorest neighborhoods.
Officially launched earlier this year, the Milwaukee Plays Initiative aims to redesign and rebuild 12 of the city's most deteriorated playgrounds, with the goal of not only getting kids active, but also to bring adults together in an effort to cultivate a sense of ownership in their community.
Here with us now to talk more about the initiative is Michael J. Murphy. He's an alderman and the president of the Milwaukee Common Council. Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be on your program.
So the origin of Milwaukee Play sounds like it was personal for you. Why did you feel it was important to focus on playgrounds in Milwaukee?
It was personal. My parents are immigrants to the United States from Ireland, and when they arrived here, they came here with $50 in his pocket and two young children, and they raised their family here in the heart of our city. And quite honestly, you know, my father worked very hard, two jobs as a laborer, and we didn't have the opportunities a lot of kids may have had to go up north to a resort or to a cottage. We grew up on the playgrounds of our city, and I learned a lot of great lessons at an early age, how to pick teams, how to have good social interaction, how to play chess. And those were important lessons that I learned, and I've seen the deterioration of our playgrounds over the years. And I felt strongly a lot of the kids that that much like me don't have the same opportunities that a lot of kids may be in our suburban communities, but we should make sure we take care of our playgrounds and provide the same opportunities that I had as a kid, that they should have the same today.
It sounds like to you it's not just the restoration of these playgrounds. It's something bigger that gets restored when the playgrounds get restored. What is that something bigger?
You know, all too often in the past, it was just some engineer saying, okay, we have a swing that's broken, we'll just replace the swing. I want to see these to be more of an innovation in terms of evolving a bottom-up approach from the community. So what we've done is we're working with the neighborhood leaders and asking them and providing them an opportunity to help design that playground. A lot of wonderful playgrounds are being designed around the United States, and I want the neighborhood to take ownership of this and say, what do we want to have at this location? How does this interrelate with our housing in the neighborhood? How does it relate to public safety, which is a critical issue in our city and across so many cities in the United States right now? And I want the neighborhood to take ownership of this, whether it's an intergenerational playground or a top lot. What do they want to see there? So this is to build a community.
So how does that work? How do you get a neighborhood to come together to plan a playground? It's probably not something most people have experience with.
Well, I have had a great partner in this. The Zilber Family Foundation, under the leadership of Susan Lloyd, has awarded us a grant of $300,000 to help match some private public money. And the key component of that is involving the neighborhood leadership. So we go out to the community with a neighborhood letter saying, come to a neighborhood meeting. We want to talk about this as a project. We involve faith leadership. We involve the Black Watch captains. And then that group will pick their leadership to serve on an ad hoc committee to help design and plan this playground.
And do you have some ideas in mind about what these playgrounds could look like, a template that you're working with?
Well, we're going to provide a palette of different choices for citizens to choose from. So we've met with a lot of contractors who have done very really creative things throughout the United States, some using, as I mentioned, intergenerational equipment that's been tested and proven to be effective in Minneapolis, changing the topography of the playground. The Lake Michigan Foundation has awarded us a grant of $25,000 to make these hard surfaces to be more with, you know, grass and greenway, changing maybe the topography of the playground so kids can have an opportunity to run up a hill and enjoy maybe an orchard that we could plant there. So these are some of the creative ideas that we're going to provide the neighborhood to be able to choose from.
Now, the 12 playgrounds that you want to work with have been designated as the most deteriorated. What kind of condition are they in?
Well, I asked our Department of Public Works to review all the 60 playgrounds in the city of Milwaukee where we've made an investment in. And I'm sad to say, over the years, the investment has been cut back over time because of other resources being taken away for other activities. And as a result, we have identified these 12 playgrounds based on a quantitative analysis of when investment was made into them. So in some cases, these playgrounds have had no investment in over 20 years. And, you know, kids are hard on equipment. And as a result, they've gotten deteriorated, and some of them are in very rough shape. And, you know, we need to put some life back into them. So this is a public-private partnership. The city is putting some money into it, but I'm also aggressively trying to raise private money.
Now, I read that another thing you'd like to do is to involve some of the older youth, I guess this would be teenagers, in kind of leading playground programming. How would that work?
Well, it's a summer employment program. So we want to provide older youth who may live in the neighborhood to be play leaders, to train them to help younger children engage in safe and organized and outdoor games and other play. You know, we have too many kids in Milwaukee and really throughout many of our cities where the obesity is at all-time high. We have a terrible problem with diabetes. And a lot of these kids are just too many times stuck playing these electronic games, which, you know, they're good in some ways. I have a 9.5-year-old, and admittedly, you know, sometimes you need a break. but the reality is I want them out there and exercising and learning how to play. You know, you and I probably grew up on these playgrounds and we learned to play all these games, whether it be red light, green light, capture the flag. A lot of these kids, they have no idea what you're talking about. You know, and it teaches social interaction, social responsibility, and having the older adult kids who live in the neighborhood take ownership of it, helping them to teach these type of games to these kids, I think spreads an important message.
Do you think this would end up being, in your vision, something that's more than just for kids and the older kids and the adults who plan it, but are playgrounds really community gathering space, or do they have the potential to be?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. They are community gathering places. I want these to be places where you have grandparents, parents and children using these resources, feeling safe and secure. I mean, there's no reason why you couldn't have a yoga class at these locations or a Tai Chi class while kids are playing at the tot lot or doing other activities. We need more of these places in our city where people feel safe and secure and proud of, and that the city is not turning its back on them and investing in them and making sure people realize we care about them. And if you care about people and they show that through the actions that we're going to take, people will take better care of their neighborhood.
You mentioned the changing landscape, I guess, of childhood about kids playing more video games, leading more sedentary lives. Do you think having a playground is going to make a difference, or has society maybe just made a cultural shift toward a different kind of childhood now that maybe is less playground-focused?
Well, in all the academic research we've looked at, and we've looked at a considerable bit of it, a lot of these trends are not positive trends. In terms of kids' lack of physical activity, it really interferes with their mental capabilities as growing up as children. There is a real important interaction, a play that's creative and makes because that'll help them in their education going further. So, if anything, I'm hoping to change that discussion here in a small level in the city of Milwaukee of trying to change that whole landscape of that. We need to get back to some of the basic things that were successful for you and me and our grandparents. It's not to say the electronic games and the other things are not valuable, but without having an active and physical strong body, your mind does deteriorate.
Now, not everyone is familiar with all the neighborhoods in Milwaukee, but are there particular neighborhoods that you're looking at saying this is a playground that would really mean a lot to this particular neighborhood?
Well, a good example that the Zilber Family Foundation has done a lot with the Layton Boulevard West neighborhood. It's a neighborhood on the south side of Milwaukee, which has a very diverse population of older white residents and a stronger growing Latino population and Asian. And this is a playground that's a pretty sizable playground over a square block in radius, and it just is falling into disrepair. And this playground could really serve as an anchor in helping this neighborhood. It's seen some improvements in its commercial corridors. It's an up-and-coming neighborhood. We see more young families moving into this area. But when they look at that playground and they realize that it's falling apart and there's been no investment in many years in it, that's the wrong signal to give. And so if we can turn that around a little. You know, I think a lot of times people look at some of the problems facing our urban environment and our cities, and you can talk about Baltimore, and people throw up their hands and say, oh, there's nothing I can do about it. But, you know, you got to start somewhere. And if it means starting the first step of helping improve a playground in a neighborhood, well, that's a concrete action we can do to make a difference. And hopefully you do these small steps and they grow. So these 12 playgrounds we hope to do in the next 2 to 3 years, we hope to see that kind of spin off to the neighborhoods also.
Now, you're looking at 12 particular playgrounds here, the ones that are designated most deteriorating, but is 12 enough?
Well, I have to be realistic. So the budget I'm trying to raise is over $1.6 to $1.9 million. And, you know, I know that you're going through fundraising efforts yourself, and you know how tough it is to raise money. So right now we've been very lucky to have the Zilber Family Foundation with the first grant of $300,000. But my goal is to raise over $1 million privately and then supplant the rest with public money. I think this is a great first start, but perhaps maybe we can grow it.
Now, it's been a tough year for Milwaukee. In the past few months, we've seen a big uptick in gun violence, shooting deaths, and so some people might look at that and say, in the grand scheme of things, playgrounds might not be at the top of the to-do list. But do you see this as part of a bigger fix for some of Milwaukee's problems?
Yeah, and it's not an either-or. We are doing a lot of other things. I'm going to be announcing an initiative next week to get kids in our community to talk about asking them for their visions, what they want to see for a safe summer, and providing resources to them on their best ideas, working from elementary to high school. There's a number of initiatives we're working with the police department, a number of with neighborhood groups. There's a lot of good success stories out there in our city. All too often, we always focus on the negative. It's not that I'm not being realistic, but I think sometimes the only message you hear is all the negative stories. There's a lot of good people in this city who are working tirelessly to make an improvement. Yes, this is not an answer to all the problems that we're facing in our city. Of course not. But I do think it's concrete action to showing that we are trying to make a difference.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
That was Michael J. Murphy, Alderman and President of the Milwaukee Common Council. He's the creator of the Milwaukee Plays Initiative, which looks to redesign and rebuild 12 of the most deteriorated playgrounds in Milwaukee.